Dear listener, we hope that you've been enjoying the variety of podcasts that we have on our network. Now is your opportunity to help us by telling us a little more about you. Please visit jcastnetwork.org/survey and complete our listener survey so that we can learn more about you and your listening habits. Again, please visit jcastnetwork.org/survey. Thanks so much.
Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finman. We've got a really great show for you today. In this half hour of the show, we're going to be interviewing Professor Stephen Fine, who's written a book called The Menorah, From the Bible to Modern Israel. It's Hanukkah, and we'll talk about the relationship there. This is definitely going to be quite informative, and he's a very entertaining fellow that's in this half hour of the show. The portion of the week, which we'll be talking about in the second half hour of the show, is the portion of Vayishlach, continuing with Bible stories in the book of Genesis chapter 32 and following. We've got a wide selection of Jewish music for your listening pleasure. A wonderful Hasidic story about the Alter Rebbe, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, whose Yahrzeit, the anniversary of his passing, no, excuse me, not his Yahrzeit, the day of his liberation from jail, from a communist jail, is in this week. It'd be 210 years. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. Israel fired missiles at a Syrian military airbase, destroying several buildings. It is believed that the airport was used for smuggling weapons into Syria. Israel has made no comment on the incident. Israeli police broke up a Hamas terrorist cell, arresting 8 Arab teenagers in Jerusalem. The group was planning a shooting spree on Mount Scopus and an IDF base. Israel's Knesset passed a law legalizing 55 towns and 4,000 apartments in the West Bank. The move comes after Israel's Supreme Court ruled that the town of Amona near Jericho is illegal and must be evacuated. The U.S. Congress passed a bill giving Israel $600 million for a new missile defense system. President Barack must now sign the bill. In continuing news of the BDS movement, Nevada and Ohio became the latest states to introduce a law against the anti-Israel BDS movement. That's boycott, divestify, and diversify, and sanction. The legislation would prohibit the state from contracting with companies that engage in boycotts of Israel, including companies located outside of the state. 4 Arab smugglers were killed in a smuggling tunnel linking Gaza to the Sinai Peninsula. The tunnel was flooded by the Egyptian army. And finally, Israel ranks number 2 in the world's per capita consumption of sugar behind Malaysia. Israelis take an average 170 grams per day of sugar, while 24 to 32 is considered to be an acceptable limit. If you're wondering, Americans on average consume 76 grams of sugar per day. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Herschel Finman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. We have Professor Stephen Fine, who's a professor at the Yeshiva University in New York. He's a professor of Jewish history, has just recently written a book called the menorah from the Bible to modern Israel. And that's what we're going to be talking about, the menorah. How are you doing today, Professor Fine?
Great. Hello, Detroit. How are you?
We're doing well here. Okay, so looking at the book, which I find very fascinating myself, you seem to have this, like, fascination with the menorah that didn't seem to be that just recently say, I'm going to write a book about the menorah. But it seems like something that was, like, been piqued your interest maybe even when you were a kid. Is that true?
Yeah, it piqued my interest even as far back as I can remember as a little kid going to shul. Absolutely. I've been with the menorah through high school, through my BA, through my MA. Almost all of my books have menorahs on the cover at this point. So when my kids call me the menorah man, there's more than just a joke in it.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think about it, fascination? What grabbed your attention way back when, even as a little kid there, Steve?
Well, first of all, I love fire. And so that was an easy one for the Hanukkah menorah. But then right after the Six-Day War, when I found out that it was a symbol of the State of Israel as a really little kid, I just jumped. And remember the day in May in 1967 when my mother was crying and the day in June when she was exuberant. And that was a moment when the light of the menorah seemed so evident to everyone and has stuck with me ever since.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Okay, now let's talk about the menorah. Is the menorah first appears in the Bible, in the book of Exodus, when the Jews are commanded to make a sanctuary, and this is supposed to be a symbolic expression of light, and the temple's supposed to have light. It wasn't used necessarily to people should be able to see in the dark, per se. I would like to know, though, there are examples of altars that predate, like, the biblical need for an altar. Are there, or were there, any evidence that there was menorahs that were used in other services pre the building of the sanctuary in the desert, Stephen Fine?
First of all, the word menorah comes from the word ner, which means light, and it means a lighting fixture. And so there are lots of lighting fixtures throughout the ancient Near East, often to represent divine light, though not God of Israel's light. But more to the point, just successfully to provide light in very dark sanctuaries, like the tabernacle, like many other places where people would go for religious experience, but nothing with these branches. In other words, there are lots of lampstands that are tall and have a lamp on top, or even multiple lamps on sitting on the top, but the idea of a lampstand with the seven stalks coming out of the sides, that doesn't appear before the Torah.
Okay. Now, so there's all this discussion about the menorah in the Bible, that it was the way it's described in the Bible. You bring it out in your book. I remember the first time reading about this when I was studying the book of Exodus and just scratching my head. The physical description of it is very, very complicated, and there's things that there's bulbs and flowers and knobs and branches and what is the significance of all that? If you're going to have a menorah and you want to have light, okay, so you have like this, as you say, like a tall reed thing, something straight, and you put a couple of lights on it, and voila, there you go, you're good to go. But this seems to have more than that.
Yeah, it has an awful lot more than that, because the description of all the tools and parts of the tabernacle are given in such detail in the Torah, and it's given twice. And so first you do it, then you did it. But the overarching theme is make it according to the image that God has shown. In other words, there's a heavenly prototype to what's being made down on the earth. So it has that deep correlation between what human beings are trying to do down below and what God is imagining for us from up above. The complexity of the description of the menorah, like the other parts of the tabernacle, I think it's because you can't put an object like that in words. Sometimes I'll give my students a paper cup and ask them to describe it in detail in words, and that's even hard. Can you imagine trying to do something as complex as the menorah, which medieval rabbis looked at and said, I don't know exactly what's going on here. There's just too much going on. So if you lived in the Iron Age or before, you would look at the menorah, you'd think of lampstands of your period, you might have even seen the original, and say, oh yeah, that's what this description is. But for those of us looking way out, it's a kind of poetry. Giving that much detail is a poetic attempt, a compulsive and poetic attempt to make this thing real, where our imaginations fail us.
Okay. Now, the menorah that was used in the temple, in the, first in the sanctuaries and then the various temples, it says in the Book of Exodus it has to be made out of pure gold. I have a friend who is a goldsmith. He was actually commissioned to do the menorah, which is in the Lubavitch World Headquarters. And he's
an amazing man, by the way.
Yeah, Herschel Pecker really is.
Yes, he's an amazing man.
He was showing me how the thing was done, and he did it. He kind of cheated because he used gold tubing and iron rods. And I said, well, what are the iron rods for?
Yeah, he got the easy way. Yeah.
So he said, well, because if we're doing it out of gold, the weight of the gold would be such that the outer branches would be heavier than the inner branches. And what you would have, instead of having the menorah in a straight line, which is what's mandated, it would bow outwards. So he, according to Herschel Pecker, this goldsmith, the menorah, just the making of the menorah, the fact that it would be able to exist in the shape that we have it, or we imagine it, was itself miraculous. Would you like to comment on that, Stephen Fine?
Sure. First of all, pure gold never means really pure gold. In fact, there are commentaries from the world of the Talmud that describe that having red gold and green gold and blue and white gold. Why? Because gold always has to have something in it to strengthen it. That's number one. Number two, I don't know about Herschel's technology, but I know that he used, just as the people in Jerusalem who've recently made a great big menorah, have used a base metal interior for their lampstands. Now, I point out that the Torah doesn't describe the shape of the branches of the menorah. In fact, it doesn't call them branches. It doesn't have that tree resonance that medieval rabbis see, but rather describes them as kanim, as reed, right?
As reeds, yes.
History, at least reeds. Throughout the Second Temple period, all Jews read it as straight branches. Throughout almost all of the all Jews read them as rounded branches. In the Second Temple period, Jews read as representing the paths of the planets from both the historian Josephus and from the philosopher Philo. And you know, the round branches have been standard. There is a blip. It's just where Maimonides drew an image in his commentary on the Mishnah, an early rabbinic text, where he put straight branches and said really explicitly, but I don't draw very well. Mm-hmm. Son, however, Abraham, but he really had to make straight branches, which sway into the Spanish tradition of my interpretation, and then into the Yemenite tradition of interpretation of the menorah, and then it found its way in the 80s to Rabbi Menachem Rosner's and the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and it spread from there. But it's been a very, very minority tradition. Having said that, we have no idea what the Torah's branches look like, but we know that by the century BCE, it's universally round until the Maimonides be drawn.
Mm-hmm. Understood. Okay, there's a lot of speculation about what happened to the menorah in the Second Temple, but I've never seen anything anywhere discussed what happened to the first menorah, which was built by Bezalel and lasted through to the destruction of the first temple by Nebuchadnezzar. Got any insights on that one, Steve?
It doesn't find its way listed in the text that's about this, like the Aron HaBrit, the Ark of the Covenant. It's just to any of the sources that say what happened to this stuff, starting with Jeremiah. There is this generalized notion that a lot of the objects were taken off to Babylonia, and we know that the big thing coming back from Babylonia was that many of the objects didn't come back. For example, the Urim and Thummim, the stones of the high priest's breastplate, which had direct communication with God, didn't back, which required great ingenuity by the Chachamim of the age of Ezra and Nehemiah, the leaders of the community, figure out what to do having a communication with God. And so a lot of these kinds of objects got lost and continued to get lost. One of the things about gold, though, is it never quite disappears. So it's reused and reused and reused. Even from ancient Rome, there are very, very few gold objects that continue to this day. It's just some cups and stuff. And so, as I tell everyone, I don't know where any of the various menorahs in Jewish history are. There is not. But I can do that. Maybe we bring it in your wedding ring. Because gold doesn't disappear.
Mm-hmm. Understood. You're leading into the next question that I have, and that the Ark of Titus, which is in Rome, depicts a way up in the corner over there, and it's really hard to see if you're actually standing next to it, is the person carrying what we call a menorah. It's a seven-branched candelabra thing. It's like really big compared to the person this is not some little tabletop model thing over there. That's been adopted as like the symbol of the State of Israel and is the prevalent opinion as to what the menorah in the temple looked like. So tell us about then this depiction of the menorah in the Ark of Titus, and that would segue into, well, I've always thought that the Romans, who were like really gold hungry, probably just took it and melted it down, but I did hear a lecture by a colleague of yours, Rabbi Benjamin Bloch, say that he believes it's in a sub-basement in the Vatican. So if you could address both of those questions, Professor Stephen Fine.
Sure. First of all, the Ark of Titus presents a number of the objects brought from the temple in Jerusalem and paraded through Rome in the year 70. They were put into a place called the Temple of Peace, which asserted Roman dominance over the world after an incredibly difficult internal discussion that led to the choice of Vespasian and then Titus as emperor. And so the menorah that was represented on this frieze, on this bas relief, along with the table that's represented on this bas relief, and the horns of the temple, the Hatzor Throat, were put on display close by. So anybody who went to see the reliefs could walk 150 meters or so down the hill and see the actual menorah up through the 2nd, 3rd, or 5th century. We're not sure which. Image that you see there is likely one of the menorahs that existed in the temple. There were a lot of them. Anybody who's ever been on a synagogue committee knows that you get rules from the synagogue community to the artisans, right? Build a Torah ark, put lions on top, but no one ever tells them all the little details. My guess is that whatever very rich Jews gave this menorah, no one said, by the way, the base is supposed to be X and Y, and they made this one, and that's the one the Romans liked, and it's as simple as that. As to the menorah at the Vatican, it's a myth that's been spread since the 1960s. It's a response to the Second Vatican Council. No one ever said it before the 1960s. It appears nowhere in Jewish literature. When the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe went to Rome, according to stories told by Baruch Schneerson, there's no mention of seeing a menorah. When rabbis have gone to Rome in previous generations, they've looked for all sorts of temple stuff. They never found it. When the Israel Antiquities Authority was bothered by government people and went looking in the Vatican, there's nothing there. There is no menorah at the Vatican. Rabbi Bleich can think whatever he wants.
Okay, fair enough. I'm not going to challenge him.
In other words, it is an urban myth that firm Jews like, Orthodox Jews like, mm-hmm. conservative Jews sometimes like, Reform Jews like, Israelis like. But let me tell you something. I don't have horns on my head, and there are people all over America and the Midwest who think I do.
Uh-huh. Okay, we're going to put it on the same level as that.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about the menorah as far as iconography goes. There's lots of things that could have been Jewish symbols. The menorah got chopped on by all the things. Even I was thinking about myself. I've were on two major programs in this city. One of them was called the Jewish Judicial Seminar, and our logo was a menorah. Instead of the base, we at the bottom we had the scales of justice. And now I've just started a new organization called Jewish Ferndale. And so, what's our logo? It's a fern with a menorah placed overlaid on top of it. So it's really become
how fun.
Yeah, it's really quite acceptable. It's like this is like yeah, we're going to use it. We're going to use a menorah of a Jewish temple. Let's now if we're saying that it's because it was from the temple that it was used. Well, listen, the ark was more important than the menorah was. So how is it that the menorah became the icon?
First of all, making an image of an ark means making a picture of a wooden box. It's nothing special looking.
You got the cherubs on the top.
Yeah, but you have to really simplify in order to do it. And once you've simplified it to the sort of image that can be put as a branding image, it gets more and more complex. And anybody who's ever tried to do it has had to add words or something else and explain it. So it's really not a good branding image. And there's the table, which is even worse branding image because it's like putting a picture of your dining room table on a symbol. And when Bar Kochba tried it in the second century, it failed to the point that people today have a hard time identifying a table when they see it. The menorah, on the other hand, has a great ability to be simplified and simplified and simplified. And even if you find a piece of it with a couple of branches and the central stalk, you know you're looking at a menorah. It is the greatest branding symbol, perhaps, before the golden arches. It's an amazing simplification that everybody recognizes. In other words, as Christians later on, Christians later on in the 4th and 5th century picked up on the cross because it was a very simple way of expressing very deep theological beliefs. Jews during the first century of the common era picked up on the menorah for that very thing. They could put it on a prayer lamp, they could put it in a synagogue, they could put it in a tomb, and anybody can draw it as opposed to among the other image. Try asking people to make the image of the table for the showbread, it will look like your dining room table. Ask people to make the Ark of the Covenant, God knows what comes out. But ask them to draw a menorah, and it will come out every time looking like a menorah. And that's the amazing branding capacity of an object described in the Torah as coming right from God in a way that even Moses couldn't understand. Okay. And he required a person with visual capacity to go through all of those biblical verses and all of those ideas and look at that image shown by God and say, okay, that's what it's talking about. Now, once you take a menorah and simplify it, somebody's four-year-old child can draw it, and everyone knows what it is. And that's an important piece for community to have that level of simplification so that whether you are the most educated interpreter, whether you are the most simple interpreter, everybody says, that's a menorah. Okay. And that's the Jews.
So archaeologically speaking, how far back would you say that the icon of the menorah being used as a Jewish symbol shows up?
Is in 39 BCE, the last of the Maccabees and Antigone was being chased by Herod, who became Herod the Great and rebuilt the temple, and was deposed. And Maccabees used both the menorah and the image of the table, which again isn't very successful, on a coin in order to rally Judea against the Romans and against Herod. Mm-hmm. That's the first time, and then it spread from there.
Mm-hmm. Just an interesting side note. We had, I noticed in the book that the credit for the picture of that coin was from the collection of Shlomo Mosiyev, and I had never heard of Shlomo Mosiyev until last week, because last week we had a representative from Sotheby's who was having a Judaic auction of the collection of Shlomo Mosiyev. And I didn't understand the importance of it last week, but now I really see that it is quite an amazing collection. So he had these coins from 1,000 years ago.
He was an amazing man too, Shlomo Mosiyev. He was an amazing man and a bald stuck up person who gave huge amounts of money for all sorts of Jewish studies, along with having one of the best collections of archaeology and Jewish art in the world.
Indeed. I'm assuming once I see the name, it's coming up all over the place. What about the menorah versus, say, the Jewish star? as an icon.
Jews have used stars for a long time. Jews have used stars for a long time, right? Not just because of Vincent van Gogh and Starry, Starry Night, but that's part of it. As we look up into the sky, and Jewish time is structured based upon the stars and the planets, and the Jewish is based upon the moon, right? And so, and the lights on the top of the menorah are the set, according to Zechariah, according to Zechariah, the seven eyes of God, the sun, the moon, and the five visible planets. And so the heavens have been very close to Jewish experience for a long time. But it wasn't until the 18th century when the Jews of Prague chose this image with a symbol of a Jew's hat in the center to be the symbol of the Jews of that community, and it spread from there. It seems that the reason it's been so popular is specifically because it has just enough Jewish content to be recognizable, but not enough to look too religious. And so Jews from left to right adopted it as a simple cipher that wasn't biblical and wasn't so religious and said Jewish community. And for some people it was read as religious, and some people it was read as not. A menorah can hardly ever be read as not religious.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so it had the advantage of being a little bit more quiet. If you remember the parade of the 60s, where people would walk down the street holding up their fingers in the shape of a V, right? Mm-hmm. Anything from the Jewish peaceniks, social anarchists, to the West, it all meant something different, but they were united in the same parade with the same hand signal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so a Star of David became a way of unifying the Jews visually, even as it itself didn't have a whole lot of content, which made it very different from the menorah.
Mm-hmm. I was actually noticing in the collection, which is being auctioned, that there is a ketubah, which is about 700 years old, which is illuminated just in an amazing way. And there are pentagrams all over it, not six stars, but five. And I know from growing up and, you know, seeing all those horrible movies that the pentagram was like the sign of the devil. And here it was on a Jewish document. So I guess it kind of developed out from the five to the six over the course of time. So
No. They had both at the same time. And symbols change meaning. Remember that in Germany, the double meander became a swastika, but in India, it's a sign of good luck. When they found an ancient synagogue in Engedi near the Dead Sea, and it had had what looks like a swastika on it, the excavator, who's the child of a Holocaust survivor, cringed, even though he knew that this had nothing to do with Nazis, right?
Mm-hmm.
Images change meaning over time. One of the things I wrote in my book is that the challenge of a symbol like the menorah is that it causes us to remember and then re-remember and then re-remember again, based upon who we are and what we are, those things that are dear to us. And it's a challenge to keep our connectedness and to remain vital all at once. And the light of the menorah provides access, at least for me, to some of that possibility.
Okay. We have one more question. This is going to have to wrap it up. I'm just fascinated. I could talk about this for another hour. But the people, when you think menorah, I mean, this is December now, and people think menorah, they think Hanukkah. And Hanukkah, we light this thing that we call a menorah, which technically speaking really is not a menorah. It's a Chanukiah. But the acceptance of the universal acceptance of the menorah and the celebration of Hanukkah, if you just briefly touch on that, Professor Stephen Fine.
Sure. First of all, the word Chanukiah was used in Sephardi communities in the Balkans and seemingly in other places for a long time. But Ashkenazim, Jews from Europe and many other places, always refer to the lamp for Hanukkah as a menorah, even though they don't look the same as a seven-branch menorah. One's a Hanukkah menorah and one's a seven-branch menorah. Why? Because they both mean lampstand, right? They both mean a fixture for light. Now, they both mean fixture for light. Why would we use the same name for both? Because every time you light your Hanukkah menorah, it's in memory of the menorah of the temple. And when we light our Hanukkah menorahs, we are doing it together with the Maccabees, those pure and holy ones, according to the prayer book, who went into the temple and rekindled the temple menorah. And so when I light my lights at home, I'm rekindling the temple menorah, and like the Maccabees, I'm giving new hope to Jews, and at least to my family, year in and year out, on what's essentially the winter solstice, the darkest day of the year.
Wonderful. That's great. Okay, so we have been interviewing, we've been talking with Professor Stephen Fine. He's a professor of history, Jewish history at Yeshiva University. The book is called The Menorah, From the Bible to Modern Israel. It is published by Harvard University Press, available on Amazon and wherever one goes to buy Jewish books. Thank you so much. This has been absolutely delightful speaking with you, Professor Fine.
I've had so much fun. Thank you so much.
Okay, take care. All of you, and a happy and a healthy Hanukkah. Okay, that's going to do it. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Herschel Finman, here you are listening to The Jewish Hour. That was great. That's going to go down as an all-time great interview. And the book is really cool. It's a wonderful book. It's got tremendous pictures in it, different menorahs throughout the ages. Up next, we're moving on. This is Avram Fried, new song, Biyadcha Hashem. I'm putting myself into your hands, Hashem.
Yudati, ki hinni be yotchu levad, ki hinni be yotchu levad. Kach oimer be yad hayotzair. Riboyno oylemim yudati. Ki inni be yotchu levad. Ki inni be yotchu levad. Kach oymer be yad hayotzay. Hay ve im gam me samays bi ait sois bi sach bi lois ve sach bi lois de ve khol yo ich vay sai val ya medi li mi ni le oy shi ay ni mit lis moy khnafshi mi bala va vaday mi bala dai skhu ve ez rasu ay nay nay ne zru ye yeshiyo.
Want assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Hey, Schulfenman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. Next is a little klezmer music. This is Alle Brider, which means all brethren come together. It features Yitzhak Perlman, the famed violinist, together with the Klezmatics. Let's do it. Someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968, MDS Drug Detox. Herschel Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. We have, which if you're listening on 1500, I have to make this note, you could be listening on 92.7 in on the FM dial and listening in stereo. So just move it up along that way. Next, for your listening pleasure, this is actually a very cute song. This is Tom Lehrer, who's not exactly known for Jewish music per se. He's a parodyist, and this is indeed a parody. This is called Hanukkah in Santa Monica.
I'm spending Hanukkah in Santa Monica, wearing sandals, lighting candles by the sea. I spent Shavuos in East St. Louis, a charming spot, but clearly not the spot for me. Those eastern winters, I can't endure them, so every year I pack my gear and come out here till Purim. Rosh Hashanah I spend in Arizona, and Yom Kippur way down in Mississippi. But in December there's just one place for me. Amid the California flora, I'll be lighting my menorah like a baby in his cradle. I'll be playing with my dreidel, spending Hanukkah in Santa Monica by the sea. I'm spending Hanukkah in Santa Monica, wearing sandals, lighting candles by the sea. I spent Shavuos in East St. Louis, a charming spot, but clearly not the spot for me. Those eastern winters, I can't endure them, so every year I pack my gear and come out here till Purim. Rosh Hashanah I spend in Arizona, and Yom Kippur way down in Mississippi. But in December there's just one place for me. Amid the California flora, I'll be lighting my menorah like a baby in his cradle. I'll be playing with my dreidel. Here's the Judas Maccabeus. Boy, if he could only see us spending Hanukkah in Santa Monica by the sea.
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurances accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Herschel Finman here. You are listening to The Jewish Hour. This week is the portion of Vayishlach, chapter 32 and following in the book of Genesis. A lot of really good stuff over here. We have lots of allegory, things going on. There's lots of conflict in this week's portion. We're going to talk about specifically the conflict. It's told that Jacob was transporting his family from lower Mesopotamia back to the land of Canaan, and he went and crossed his family over and crossed the Yabbok, which is a tributary to the Jordan, which is probably more like a creek than a river at that point. And he forgot something. We have a joke among Hasidim that it says he forgot Pachim Ketanim. Pachim Ketanim is little jars. And that everything for a righteous person is precious. So he doesn't overlook anything. So, but among Hasidim, we say he forgot his shot glasses because he's going to go have a, he's going to sit down with his brother. He's going to, you know, pour a shot of vodka for him and a shot of vodka for him. They'll sit down, they'll farbreng, they'll have a Hasidic gathering. So you needed to have his shot glasses, right? While he was alone on the other side of the Jabbok, on the Yabbok River, he is accosted by, he's attacked, but by a stranger, which turns out to be an angel. And he's wrestling with this angel an entire night. Who is this angel? This angel is the ministering angel of the of Esav. It says, every entity in the world, it says, there's not a blade of grass that doesn't have an angel that smacks it and causes it to grow. Meaning, every organism has a connection to the Almighty. Countries, people, for sure have a connection to the Almighty. So now, here's Esav's angel. What's the deal? Yaakov is going to now encounter Esav. Esav is coming to battle Jacob. And even though their mother was told at this point 108 years prior that there'll be contention between the two and one will never be able to vanquish the other, eventually one does. That's the eventuality of it. And in this instance, we always say that Jacob is analogous of good, and Esav is analogous of evil. And what was, there's this constant battle now between good and evil, and it goes on, not just out in the world, it goes on with inside of us. We're constantly battling, no, I don't want to do the wrong thing, or no, I want to do the wrong thing, but I'm not going to do the wrong thing. Ultimately, good wins. So the angel, understanding that if Jacob were to battle Esav at that time, and it was going to be a fight to the finish, Esav would be the one who would get finished off. In which case, this angel, whose name is Samael, would be out of a job. Now, there's no such thing as an unemployment rate up in heaven. There are no angels that are walking around just like kicking it back. Hey, I'm collecting unemployment now because I got no country. No, angels that have nothing to do get evaporated. So this angel is really doing a COA over here, which stands for covering one's anatomy, to guarantee that he's got a job the day after tomorrow. It is because of this fighting that the Jewish people are called Israel. The story goes, it's right there in the Bible. They're wrestling back and forth, and finally the angel says, listen, it's my turn to lead the prayers up in heaven. I got to go. You got to let me go. So Jacob says, listen, I didn't get this far. I didn't wrestle with you a whole night just for you to say, okay, oops, sorry. Sorry to bother you, but I got to go now. No. He said, I got to get something out of the deal. He says, I want you to bless me. So he says, okay, I'll give you a blessing. He says, what's your name? He says, my name's Jacob. He says, okay, your name's not going to be Jacob anymore. Now your name's going to be Israel. And Jacob says, okay, fine. Thank you very much. Goodbye. Have a nice day. What happened over here? What kind of blessing? Abraham got a blessing that his children are going to be as numerous as the stars of the sky and the sands of the sea, etc. And he's going to inherit the land. Jacob gets a blessing. He gets his name changed. Thank you very much. I have a brother whose name is Yisroel Yaakov, both of those names, which is quite common. Yaakov, Yisroel Yaakov. Yeah. And then when we look through the Bible, Abraham, his name was Avram, and his name was changed to Abraham, and we never see the name Avram again. As soon as Jacob gets done, it says over there, and Jacob walked away. It doesn't even say Yisroel. Because what was now that he was given? The word Yisroel means a prince of God, meaning that he's in a position of responsibility. What the angel did with this blessing was give Jacob the power, and which was bequeathed to all of his children, to be primary movers and shakers as far as making the world a better place. As the expression goes, to be a light unto the nations. We're talking about that. This is Hanukkah time. But we still have the Jacob part, because Jacob comes from the word heel. And what do you do with your heel? You just walk. You just do. So we have this idea of taking into consideration everything around us and trying to make the world a better place. Bottom line, we still got to just do it. Speaking of just do it, let's take a quick commercial break. But don't go away. The Hasidic story is coming up next. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Specs Howard from the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. We're happy to sponsor the Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding for the Jewish Hour comes from its sponsors, it's listeners like you that help keep the Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to the Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. That's 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Your help is greatly appreciated.
Hey, Shul Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? Best way, rabbifinman.com. You'll find right there on the homepage a way to contact me. You contact me, I contact you. Everybody's happy. We love each other. Yes, wonderful. I get new best friends, and hopefully so do you. You'll also find archived editions of the radio show going back now for an entire year. You could listen to your heart's content and even more so. You'll also find archived editions of the U-Parsha, Hasidic U-Story, E-Parsha, which are Jewish missives conveyed in other media other than just through sound, hopefully in an entertaining and educational way. You'll also find the very important donations page. We need your help. We've been doing this for 20 years, and it amazes me that after 20 years, we're still doing it. Because if you would have told me, hey, listen, you're going to be doing this for 20 years, I think, nah, it's never going to last. But you people want us here. You know who you are. You're listening. So go to the computer, go to rabbifinman.com, hit the donations page. We're now offering actually a raffle as part of the Jewish Ferndale organization. You could win $100,000. Yes, donations are $100, and they get cheaper the more tickets that you buy. And you could do that all online and contribute. If you would like a raffle ticket, well, then drop me a line with $100 or any multiple thereof. And it's 2 for $180, 3 for $250, 5 for $360. And it goes down even more than that if you take a look at the website. And it's always appreciated. It's greatly needed. And you've come through before in the past. And we're looking forward to you coming forward now. Don't like doing internet giving? No problem. Drop your donation of any amount into an envelope and send it to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. As I mentioned at the onset of the show, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, known as the Alter Rebbe, the old rabbi, was released from Soviet prison coming up this week, the 19th day, which is, corresponds this week to the this year to the 19th of December. December and Kislev correspond. His there are many, many, many stories. So, but the one I wanted to tell involves a certain city. There was a city, I don't remember the name of this city, somewhere located many miles east of Grosse Pointe Farms. And the landowner, known in Yiddish as the Paretz, which means like the baron, the landowner, had levied some sort of horrible decree against the Jews, which was quite common in Central Europe at the time. After a period of time, there was some lobbying done and some finagling, and the decree was rescinded. So it was decided, since they had written to the rabbi for a blessing to be successful in getting out from under this decree, this horrible decree, that they should send word to say that they were indeed out from this horrible decree. There was a certain individual whose name was Shimon Blecher. Blecher means tinsmith, and that's what he did for a living. That's where the name comes from. There's actually a very funny piece that was done on the internet way back when the internet was just starting. It was just an audio conversation between a guy whose English wasn't so great and an operator. He wants the number of his friend Reuben Blecher, and so he says, "How do you spell Blecher?" So he said, "Blecher." Yeah, Blecher. So, but he means a tinsmith. And he said he wanted to pay the extra money to send it express mail. Cost more money, you know, like today it costs more money to send express. And they're saying, but you're a poor guy. He said, I will pay for it. He said, no, this is the rabbi wants, if it even comes, he says, it's not going to come so much quicker. He says, even if it comes an hour earlier because we sent it express, it's worth whatever it costs to make the rabbi happy and stop worrying about us. And so that's what he did. And he sent it off. There was, sometime later, a messenger from the rabbi came around to collect charity funds for the causes in Israel in support of the poor in Israel. And he had a letter specifically for this Shimon Blecher. And in it, he thanked him for the good news and told him that because he spent the extra effort to get the good news to him quicker, that he, Shimon Blecher, should always be a bearer of good news. And indeed, what happened to this family? This little poor Shimon Blecher suddenly started doing well in business. I guess he became like a magnate. No, he wasn't become that wealthy, but he lived comfortably well, and he made it a point every once in a while to write a letter to the Rebbe telling him what good things were happening. So let's focus on the good things. We hope you have a good week. We had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope you had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope to see you back again next week. Take care.